Drive, a Miami-based magazine, was having a big party celebrating my being on their cover. I was happy to do it because I liked the article and the accompanying pictures. At the event, the editor of the magazine comes up. "Oh my God, I loved hashtag period watch," he says. "It was the hashtag I created for my bloating." I laugh. "Thanks." He looks down. "I see you have a crop top on tonight." "This is my, I swear to you, I'm not pregnant outfit," I joke. It works. Reporters can tell I'm not pregnant. Habeas corpus. Present the body. But it allows for a different question instead, posed by a gaggle of perfectly nice-looking people holding iPhones and tape recorders to my face. "Do you guys want to have kids?" To avoid getting angry, I pivot toward what I think is a joke. "Have you ever asked my husband that question? Or any man?" Crickets. So I keep going. "What's happening in your uterus? How do you balance it all?" Hypothetical reporter me asks celebrity me. I pause. Less joking now. My brittle anger just peeking through. Until you ask my husband those same questions, I just can't answer them anymore. But I can't stop. I can't help myself. Do you know why no one asks men how they balance it all? It's because there is no expectation of that. Bringing home money is enough. We don't expect you to be anything more than a provider, men. But a working woman? Not only do you have to bring home the bacon and fry it up, you got to be a size 00, too. You've got to volunteer at the school. You've got to be a sex kitten, a great friend, a community activist. There are all these expectations we put on women that we don't put on men. In the same way, we never inquire about what's happening in a man's urethra. Low sperm count, huh? That why you don't have kids? Have you tried IVF? I have no takers on my rant. I am off the script, and there is no editor alive who will use those lines in a caption or post about Gabrielle's baby dreams. It reminds me of the time I did another press line with an actress who happened to know one of the reporters pretty well. "How do you stay in such great shape?" asked the reporter. "You know I don't eat," cracked my actress friend. "No, I need something I can use," said the reporter. "Oh," the actress thought for a second. "I eat broiled salmon and chicken with a lot of steamed veggies. After a while, you just really crave healthy food." There you go. There's a script. You follow it. I mean, can you imagine if I said I didn't want kids? Say I answered, "Do you and Dwayne want kids?" with "No." A woman in the public eye who doesn't want kids? She-devil. You probably kick puppies. And if you say, "Yes, I would like to have kids," they ask, "When are you starting? Have you had trouble? Are you facing infertility? What's wrong with your uterus? Do you have vaginal issues?" Wanting and not having opens you up to all these rude, insensitive, prying questions that people ask. And if you do a full open kimono and say, "Here's the deal, I am doing IVF," the questions just get more personal, deeper. "Are you pregnant this week? This month? How did this cycle work out? Is your estrogen rising? How can I watch you on Being Mary Jane if I don't know the plans you have for your uterus?" It's as if the whole world has a form and they just really, really need to know if I am pregnant. I want to scream, "Get out of my pussy! Just get the fuck out!" That's the real story. Gabrielle Union's baby hopes. Everyone needs to get out of my pussy. Chapter 16. And Gabrielle Union as the stepmother. My husband Dwayne has three sons, and in our home we are raising his two older sons, Zion, 10, and Zaire, 15, and also Dwayne's 16-year-old nephew, Davion, whom we call Dada. I am freakishly devoted to these boys. Zion is a fifth-grade genius and a born entertainer. He's me after a couple of drinks, making smart-ass comments and entertaining people. Dada and Zaire are both sophomores and girl-crazy. Dada is Mr. Cool, letting friends seek him out, while Zaire is hyper-conscious of the people around him. He is receptive to kindness, and he is the one who will call you out if you're dismissive. He is desperate to make us proud, and one of my jobs as a stepmother is to remind him how smart and amazing he is. These boys are totally worthy of all the devotion I can offer. When I first met the boys, I just wanted to be authentic. I'm a cool motherfucker, I said to myself, checking my teeth in the mirror in the minutes before the introduction. People like me. It was like we were all on a blind date. Where are you from? What are your hobbies? What are your favorite movies? And on we went. As our relationship grew, I was determined to never try to be BFFs with the boys. I did my best to be a cool, reasonable, consistent adult. That's my advice to you step-parents out there. Whatever it is that you are, just be consistent. You can't be the cool, permissive hippie one day and the disciplinarian the next. And to all current or potential stepmothers, unless the mother is dead or in jail, and even then, it's just a mistake to try to scoot into her place. No one wants their mother replaced, whether she's Mother Teresa or a serial killer. The boys were in on it when Dwayne proposed to me in December of 2013. We all went to brunch in Miami, and then the guys told me they wanted to go on a tour of our new house, which was still under construction. I say under construction, but it was more like a few pieces of wood and some nails. Are you gonna do your hair? Dwayne asked me several times. Are you gonna put on makeup? To go to a construction site? I asked. No. When we got there, the boys ran ahead of us to stand by what would eventually be our pool. We want to do a presentation for you, said Zion. I thought they were going to do some kind of skit. Turn around, said Zaire. So Dwayne and I faced away from the boys. Okay, we're ready, they said in unison. The boys were all there with a sign. Nikki, will you marry us? Oh, God, Dee, I said, thinking the boys were doing this on their own. They had been after us to get married for 2 years. This is awkward, I said, turning to Dwayne. He was down on one knee with a ring. Will you marry us? Oh, I said. Oh, this is a thing. You guys are serious. Yes, of course, yes. I love that they had agency in asking me to join the family. I never wanted to be the party crasher. The boys would have been especially vulnerable to someone trying to manipulate them because, as kids being raised by a male figure in a world that valorizes mothers as the sole models of nurturing, they all love the idea of moms. If traditional moms had trading cards, they would have all of them. The cookie baker, the classroom volunteer. I don't fit into a traditional role, and I have too much respect for myself and these boys to attempt to fake it. They worship my mom, who they call Grammy, and my dad's wife, Nana, to them. These women take being grandmothers very seriously, going to every school play and recital they can. They don't miss many. But I do. A lot of events happen when I am literally out of state at work. It doesn't matter why. All kids know is that you're missing it. It's even harder for Dee. He misses things because it's a game day or he has practice. Even if he is in town, his work hours are not like anybody else's. He doesn't have the luxury of taking off early or having someone cover his shift. There are periods of time when neither of us is present, and this is not what either of us wants. As much as I try to be consistent, I'm often just absent. It's shockingly easy to parent by text or apps like Marco Polo or WhatsApp. But that feels lazy, and the whole time I'm using any of them, I'm thinking, I'm failing them. I'm failing them. I'm failing them. I wish I had a job where the boys could see me leave for work in the morning and come home at night. They could watch me work on my lines and be a producer. I film Being Mary Jane in Atlanta, and I do movies wherever the good work is. I'm gone for a week, then swoop in for 36 hours of in-your-face time before flying out again. Even when I do get an extended break, they have the real lives of teenagers. They have family to visit and tournaments to play. As I beat myself up about this, I realize that society does not provide great models of Black women as nurturers of Black children. Maybe as caregivers to white children, or the sassy, sage, asexual sidekick to a long-suffering white woman, or maybe the beat some sense into you Black mother we've seen in viral videos, but never as loving, kind, sensitive, or nurturing to Black children. Recently, our family was in our living room in our new house in Chicago. I was on the cream couch with my feet up on Dee's lap. He was just home from practice and telling a story about the ride home. It was a brutally cold day, about 5 degrees below zero, and his driver stopped at a light. They watched a woman get her toddler out of the car and put him out on the street while getting her stuff out of the trunk. The kid was basically standing in traffic and without a coat. The light changed, but Dee's driver wouldn't go until the kid was safely out of the street. Dee nearly got out to help. The woman then put on her own coat, finally took the child's hand, and proceeded to walk down the street still holding his coat. Now, I think we've all been with small children, and yes, getting them in and out of cars is a pain in the ass. But still, it was freezing. Put the coat on the kid. Zaire and Dada both said at the exact same time. She was Black, right? Dee paused. Yeah. The positive vision of motherhood, of nurturing love, is white. And I worry that my presence flying in and flying out of their lives is not offsetting the overriding schism between Black womanhood and Black motherhood. I can't catch up enough to undo the daily damage, and I hear that familiar mantra resounding in my head. I'm failing them. I'm failing them. I'm failing. My very existence as a stepmother is a sign of failure and loss. Because, frankly, nobody likes the stepmother. The resounding message out there is, bitch, sit down. I get that the idea of a stepmom is terrifying to a lot of biological moms. It can be hard to take the idea that somebody else is helping to raise your kids. Somebody else is at school on behalf of your kids. I didn't think you'd come, a teacher or administrator will always say when I go to the school. What a surprise! Part of that is that they see me in movies and on television, but I've also seen them do that to any woman with a job. Some of the other working moms and I formed an alliance at the boys' last school, but out of all the working moms, I was the only step-parent, an understudy unfamiliar with the script, showing up and ad-libbing her ass off. As a stepmother, you have to remember your place. You play your position and stay in your lane. You don't overstep, and you're very aware that some people are waiting for that moment when you go too far. In interviews and even here in this book, I consciously refer to our boys or the boys. You're not going to catch me saying my boys, and definitely not my sons. I know how that would sound. But any parent, step or otherwise, will go hard in the paint for the kids they love. I am also very conscious that I am helping to raise young Black men in a world where they are often in danger. I have watched them grow, and I have watched the world's perception of them change as they do. Zaire is now 6'1", and Dada is 5'9". They are not freakishly tall by the standards of their classmates, but after about 9 years old, young Black boys are suddenly perceived as young Black men, and things start to change. So, for their safety, I have taken to dropping these terrible Black bombs on the boys. Black bombs are what I call the inescapable truths of being a Black person in this country. The things you do your children a disservice by not telling them about. I feel it is especially important that our boys, privileged black children in predominantly white, privileged neighborhoods know these truths. Here they are living in luxury, and here I am to say, nuh-uh, homeboy, Plymouth Rock landed on you. Things aren't going to be the same for you. I tell them this when I see that they have their privilege blinders on. The first time Zaire and Dada went to a sleepover, they were in sixth grade and we were still living in Miami. I drove them over to their friend's house and they were opening the car doors before I even finished parking. Hold up, I said. I turned to face them. They were sitting in the back seat, little duffel bags on their laps. Do not wander around this house. They looked at me dumbly. Only hang out where the family is. What? Asked Zaire. Because if something turns up missing, guess whose fault it is? Their faces were like cartoons, eyes wide like, what? They think I would steal? Asked Zaire. Yes, people think black people steal, I said. Only hang out where other people are. Have fun at the sleepover, kids. When they got older, I changed my script a bit. Don't ever put yourself alone in a room with a white girl, I told them, or in Miami, a Cuban girl. They always gave me the same look. Oh my God, please stop talking. Her family is not happy about your little black dick, I said. They're not happy about any of this. In the same way that we teach children not to run in the street, I need to teach them things to keep themselves alive. I have to tell them, you talking back to a person of authority is not viewed in the same way as when your little white friend Eddie does it. People look at Eddie and say, ah, here we have the makings of a leader, a free thinker to buck the system. It doesn't matter who your parents are, I say. You're going to be looked at as a thug or a problem child. Stand up for yourself, you're the bully. I say to myself, and the second you're not identified as Dwayne Wade's children, you are just young niggers. At one of the boys' old schools, a dean said that Dada was bullying another black kid. D was away, so I tagged in for the meeting. We had been through other incidents at this school. A boy playing basketball on the court one morning got frustrated when Zaire beat him. He called Zaire a nigger, and Dada jumped up to have his back. They didn't hit him, but this was still seen as poor behavior. Kids said nigger around the boys constantly, then blamed it on song lyrics. When I was in Pleasanton, the word simply wasn't as prevalent in music as it is now. There wasn't that handy excuse of singing it to a beat and saying, hey, it's the song. With me, it was a word the other kids had clearly heard at home. So I've taken the liberty of printing out spreadsheets for all of us, I said at the start of the meeting. You can easily follow along on the agenda that we're going to cover today. This is actually not a joke. When I go to school meetings, I come with my books and articles to support what I'm talking about, whether it's a Harvard study on implicit bias in academia or research into African-American teenagers underperforming because they go to school with the burden of suspicion. I was ready to call them on their shit. That day, I brought a copy of Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. Written as a letter to Coates' 15-year-old son, Samori, the book is a sort of guide to surviving in a black body in America. I think you should read it, I said, leaning forward to slide the book at the dean. If you're interested in better reaching the black children whose parents pay tens of thousands of dollars to attend this school. So, I said, did you label the other kid who started this disagreement a bully or just our kid? I didn't say bullying. Well, actually, you did, I said, passing him another printout. Here's an email chain where you used this very word in describing the incident to our nanny. You think our nanny from Wisconsin can't forward an email? I explain the danger authority figures put black kids in when labeling them bullies. And I noted that they felt comfortable using that term because there was near zero diversity in their faculty. What are you saying about black excellence or Latino excellence? I asked. when the examples they see here are the crossing guard and the janitors. What message do you think that sends? It was just a fact that they disciplined others differently than our black boys. How many times do our kids need to tell you that their classmates are using the word nigger? I asked. I had screen grabs of texts and emails where classmates used the word nigger, and our kids told them to stop. My kids have told you this, I said. And what did you say? That had been dismissed as typical boy behavior. Dada was a bully. The administrators told me they hadn't thought of things that way. Cue the Oprah aha moment of nodding. It was revelation time. They didn't think of things that way because they'd never had to. Here's the thing. I had to do all that, armed with spreadsheets and emails, to be taken seriously as a stepmother. At the end of the day, I could sign them out to take them to the dentist, but I didn't have the power to switch schools. That's D. That's the work of a real parent. But guess what? We switched schools. The school officials could see it coming, and I could tell a stepmother delivering the death blow made it especially painful. Our friend Phil bought a home in our Miami neighborhood and converted it into a basketball gym. Not just a court. We are talking Olympic-level training facilities. It's insane. I know this is some rich people shit. When you see me owning the court on Snapchat, that's where I am. I should say this, too. Phil Collins bought J-Lo's house up the road from us. Different Phil. However, if I could get the drum crash from In the Air Tonight playing each time I sink a basket, yes, please. The gym is about 11 blocks away from our place, and our friend Phil gave us a set of keys. Anytime you want to stop by, he said, let yourself in. It was a Tuesday night in April when Zaire and Dada asked me if they could walk to the gym. It was 9 p.m. I was reading and didn't even look up. No, it's dark. And that was that. Cut to the next night. Dee was home from the playoffs in a good mood, and they pulled the old okey-doke, like, let's get this sucker. I wasn't in the room. This time, it was 10 p.m., even later than when I said no. The boys were as sweet as could be. Can we walk to Phil's gym? Dee said, sure, here are my keys. I'm not sure if they work. I think he changed the locks, but try them. I now picture Dee in that moment, talking in a Jimmy Stewart voice. Golly, guys, try these keys repeatedly and see what happens. Then Dee casually came outside to join me on the dock. It was a beautiful night, a light wind coming off the water, honeymoon weather. Hey, babe, I said. I told the boys they could go down to Phil's. Record scratch. They just asked last night, and I told them no. It's too dark. Well, he said, I told them they could. Dee, it's too dark. People can't see them if they walk down North Bay. Babe, we've got to cut the cord sometime. I was already up, heart rate flying. North Bay is dark in some stretches, depending on how illuminated neighbors want their houses to be. You can be on a spotlit sidewalk 1 minute and lurking through trees the next. They're old enough, he said. Think about what we were doing at their age. At their age, I knew enough about the world to not trust that everything would be okay just because. This is an open carry state, Dee, I reminded him, getting agitated. A stand your ground state, and all our neighbors have to do to shoot these children is say they felt threatened. What's more threatening to our neighbors than two black boys lurking? Walking down the street in front of their properties. We don't know half our neighbors. Half of them don't live here half the time. Do you trust these people to not kill our kids? Do you trust their security to not see our boys as threatening? If someone sees them and the keys don't work? Two black kids, Dee. Two black kids. Dee paused a moment, peering at me, turning the thought over in his head. Let's go get him, he said. I had dropped another one of my black bombs, this time on him. We literally hopped in the golf cart like Mission Impossible, taking off down North Bay, D at the wheel, me dialing them on speaker. Zaire answered on the third ring. Where are you? That's how I know you're fooling around, I yelled, the panic not quite yet unleashed but slowly working its way up my chest. Where are you? Tell us specifically where you are. I think we're on 51st Street. We're walking back. The keys didn't work. I periscoped my head straight toward D, like, I told you so. As we drove our golf cart down the street, a cop car whooshed silently by. The thing about North Bay Road is that it's the most exclusive street in South Florida. A siren or a flash of police lights would denote trouble, and if you're spending $30 million on a mansion, you don't want to know there's trouble. That's why, in this neighborhood, police officers just roll up on you silently, like ninjas. Then another one magically appeared. The squad car slowed down as it reached us, and the officer rolled down the window. Instinct kicked in. Dwayne and I froze. Oh, said the cop genially. Dwayne Wade. Hi, said Dee. Have a nice night, the cop said. As he drove off, I stared straight ahead and gritted my teeth into a smile. If you think these cops were not called on our boys, you're fucking delusional, I said. These are privileged kids, I thought. Lord knows what they would say when the cops reached them. I would like to think they would be polite, but under duress, who knows? I realized it was completely possible they would say, I live here, motherfucker. Soon, we found them on the side of the road, walking toward us. Before we did, I turned to Dee. His eyes were on the road. What did you tell the kids to say when they're stopped by police? I asked him. Well, I told them what to say in case... What did you tell them? I told them to say their full names and our address. Wrong answer, I say. I'm Dwayne Wade's kid. That's what they say. As we zoomed down the road in our stupid golf cart looking for the kids, my mind flashed back to March the year before. Zaire was in seventh grade, and he'd asked if he could take our Dalmatian pit bull mix, Pink, out for a walk with Dada. It was a negotiation. Okay. Walk down to the Bosches, we said. Dee's old Heat teammate Chris Bosch lived 11 doors down the road. I figured they could walk out the door, and I would have our security call the Bosch's security to warn them. As they bounded out, I stood at the door, ready to drop a black bomb. Wrap the dog leash around your thumb, I said to them. That way, your fingers are free to spread. This was an actual conversation I had. But this is what you did 3 years after Trayvon Martin and 5 months after Tamir Rice. I didn't want the boys to have their hands in their pockets or for them to look as if they were concealing something dangerous. Zaire started to open his mouth, and I shut him down. You've got to walk Pink that way, I said. It's not just the police. It's the neighborhood security officers, too. Anyone who is armed can harm you. Sure enough, the first time they walked Pink, it was a disaster. That was the night someone swatted Little Wayne's house over on LaGuardia Island near us. Now, if you're a celebrity, swatting is a nightmare. Someone calls 911 as a prank, announces a hostage situation or shooting at a famous person's house, and watches the news as a SWAT team storms the mansion. It's happened to Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, Ashton Kutcher. Any bored 13-year-old can make a call and then watch the show. It's happened to poor Little Wayne twice. So there were two boys walking a huge dog as a dozen police cars flew past them. At our house, our security guards started to go crazy talking about a shooting. Chris's security then radioed in, practically yelling, abort mission about walking a dog. It was like an international incident. As more and more cop cars raced by the kids, they froze on the side of the road. They assumed the cars were for them. Oh my God, I imagined them saying to each other. This is what she is always talking about. The last cop car stopped and rolled down the window, just like they had done with Dee and me in the golf cart. He was looking at our two black kids. He didn't say a word, just stared. And what did Zaire do? That boy dropped the leash and ran. Dada followed. They just took off, with a pit Dalmatian running after them like boys in the waterfront community hood. I had gone over this and over this with them, but when the shit hit the Shinola, they just didn't know what to do. Zaire and Dada told us all the whole story that night in the kitchen. The boys were laughing now, the edges of the experience dulling into an anecdote. I'd poured a glass of Chardonnay to calm myself down. I swirled the wine in my mouth for a second as they talked excitedly, tasting the notes of pear and white chocolate with hints of vanilla. I was drinking wine and listening to what amounted to a boy's adventure story told in a million-dollar custom-made kitchen. None of it would protect us. "They could have shot you in the back," I said. Back to the golf cart, searching for Zaire and Dada, who were probably fumbling with their keys and looking to everyone else in the world like two black boys staging a break-in. I felt mad at them. I felt mad at Dee, and I felt mad at how black boys seem to be in constant danger. And these are not just black boys. These are big black boys, especially endangered. How are we supposed to give them all the knowledge, all the power, and all the pride that we can, and then ask them to be subservient when it comes to dealing with the police? This is how you have to act in order to come home alive. They are the boys I adore, and people don't value their very breath. It could be extinguished in 1 second without thought, leaving a dog to run, dragging its leash the whole way home. A dog, safer from harm than black boy bodies. Chapter 17. Mittens. When Dwayne moved back to Chicago to play for the Bulls, we began renting a Victorian-style house on the Gold Coast. The boy who grew up hearing shootings on the south side of Chicago now lives in the most expensive neighborhood in the city. The house was built in 1883, and one of the first owners was successful ad man Charles Kingsbury Miller, a son of the American Revolution who proudly traced his lineage to colonial families. For his post-retirement second act, he led the charge for legislation to make it illegal to disrespect the American flag. He was especially upset, he said in an 1898 Tsar banquet speech, to see the flag converted into grotesque coats for Negro minstrels. The home was recently restored to preserve its sense of history, so it is easy to imagine Charles returning to visit and the look on his face when he finds me at the door. When I am in town, I leave the house every morning to walk to the gym. In the winter, it is 8 degrees in broad daylight, and everyone and their mother is wearing the uniform of a big black puffy coat with the hood up. You can see 2 inches of everyone's face. As I walk, I see my Gold Coast neighbors scan the visible slash of my skin. They're looking to see if I belong to one of the houses. Am I the cook? The nanny? Whose girl am I? The sidewalks are narrow here because a lot of our neighbors have literally gated their shrubs. There's the shrubbery in front of their home, then the sidewalk, and then more fenced-in shrubbery before the street. Why they need to wall off their shrubbery is another topic for conversation, but the result is that if you stop to talk with somebody, you literally block the whole sidewalk. Yesterday on my walk, 2 women did just that. One had a dog on a short leash, and the other was an older woman I recognized as a close neighbor. As I approached them with their backs turned to me, I rehearsed what to say to avoid scaring them. "Excuse me, ladies," I said in my sweetest, sing-songiest voice. The older woman turned, reacting with a full face of pleasantness. But as she saw my 2 inches of skin, I watched a wave of terror come over her face as her entire body clenched. I sidled past, and as I walked away, I heard my neighbor say something I couldn't place, but then heard the last word as clear as could be. Thug. Was she talking about me? The kids? My sweet husband, who I often call Poopy? Something completely unrelated to me? Whatever the answer, I gave my workout to her. I thought about her saying thug the entire time I was on the treadmill, pounding out that run. The next day, as I layered up to make my walk to the gym, I remembered that I had two new pairs of gloves and mittens, both in black and white stripes. I instinctively reached for the gloves, but I stopped. "Well," I said out loud, "thugs don't wear mittens." I put the mittens on and went out into the street. Of course, I was fumbling with my phone because, honestly, you can't do shit with mittens on. But I was going to make my neighbors feel comfortable, damn it. Surely they would see my black face and say, "But wait, she's got on mittens. She's an acceptable Negro. She belongs. Just look at those darling mittens." That day, I decided to walk through the park instead of on the sidewalk. To save myself 2 minutes, I cut from the path to walk across a patch of grass. I was 4 steps in when I got trapped in a quicksand of icy mud. I looked down, my sneakers getting muddier and muddier, and I wasn't sure where to step next. Suddenly, a sea of children ran toward me. They were probably on a field trip racing through the park with their teachers trying to keep up. "What are the teachers going to think about this black lady?" I thought to myself, in a puffy coat and black hoodie, standing frozen in this swamp of mud. I panicked, sticking my hands out at my sides. "I've got my mittens on," I thought. "Those teachers can tell their children not to be afraid." As the kids ran around me, I tried to skedaddle past them, because that is the only word for the ridiculous walking I was doing, slipping and sliding across the icy mud. And I became furious. Had I really reassured myself that I could erase 400 years of history with these fucking mittens? Yes, the mittens were the thing that was going to separate me from the other black people who my neighbors deem threatening or, at very least, have decided don't belong on the Gold Coast. I had dared to go off the path set for me. But when I got to the gym, I didn't think about my neighbors on the treadmill that day. I thought about my friend Ricky Williams. Ricky is a retired Miami Dolphin who I met while I was doing Bad Boys 2. He would be the first to tell you that he has social anxiety, so we bonded over that right away. I called him Buddha because he was so cosmic and sweet. Like me, he likes to go for walks, and like me, he doesn't always know where he's headed. When I'm filming in new cities, I walk around and allow myself to get lost. And yes, I have been known to aimlessly follow squirrels. Ricky was showing just that trait in January of 2017 before an award ceremony in Tyler, Texas, when this ex-University of Texas prodigal's son left his hotel to kill time with a walk. Ricky was strolling through nearby woods when someone called the police because he looked suspicious. On the body cam footage, before the officers even got out of the car, one of them said, "That looks like Ricky Williams." It was actually 4 cops who arrived on the scene to search and question him. He was told to put his hands behind his back, and right after, they told him to spread his legs. A starstruck young officer asked if he was Ricky Williams. "I am." What follows presents a surreal portrait of fame and the black body. On video, the cops seem to slip in and out of seeing him as Ricky Williams, someone whose fame sets him apart, and seeing a black man in a white space. Ricky stands there as the cop runs his hands all over his body. "I'll explain everything to you in just a second," says the cop, pulling Ricky's hotel key card from his pocket. "People don't know who you are. Nothing may have happened that was wrong, but we gotta find out." When Ricky tells them he is staying at the Marriott next door, the policemen seem to leap on this fact as a reason to let him go. "If you tell me you're staying at this hotel," says one officer, "it makes a little more sense as to why you're walking around this area." Ricky then shows just the slightest crack in his Buddha cool and points out that the cop had just pulled out his hotel card. "Isn't that the whole point of searching me?" asked Ricky. "To get information?" "You're not in handcuffs. We're just talking to you." "Why would I be in handcuffs? I didn't do anything wrong." "You're acting really defensive." And then Ricky tells the truth. "Do you know how many times I've been messed with by the cops because I'm black?" "Oh, no, 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 no," says a cop. as the others shake their heads. Come on now. Yes, come on now. There was an assumption of guilt because of his very identity, and Ricky had to convince these men that he was innocent. The police stopped him as a reminder of the power structure Ricky is supposed to enforce upon himself. He should know that his skin puts him under constant surveillance, and that his very presence outside of sanctioned spaces creates the assumption of wrongdoing. It is, in fact, an inconvenience to the police that they have to be bothered to tell him this. By now, as adults, Ricky and I are supposed to have internalized these rules and regulations that come with our very existence. We put on the mittens, we utter sing-song hellos, and we stay where we belong. I cut through the little field at the park that day. If someone had stopped me and I had to try to explain my moves, why I opted to go through the park, why I came across these children, why I was sliding through the mud, if I had tried to explain myself, I might have sounded crazy. But really, all I would have been explaining away was the presence of my body in a space where it has been decided that black bodies are violent and threatening. Worse, I am told that people don't want to hear these stories, but the reality is we experience life in a never-ending loop in which we are told that if we just make it, we will enjoy the fruits of our labor. Assimilation. My father tried so hard, but he was pulled out of his Mercedes at gunpoint in Pleasanton on his way to work in a suit. The police said they were looking for an escaped convict from nearby Santa Rita jail. My father was a middle-aged man who looked nothing like the convict except for being black. There was no neighborhood outcry or protest. No one came to his defense. It was a necessary inconvenience for maintaining the safety of the neighborhood. But what does that say about aspirational living? Hey, you moved into a big house and you made it. Except you didn't. There's this idea that you will be safe if you just get famous enough, successful enough, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, move into the right neighborhood, do all these things to fully assimilate into the America people have been sold on. We all bought in, and we keep thinking if we just get over this mountain of assimilation, on the other side is a pot of gold, or maybe a unicorn, perhaps a leprechaun. Any of those is as plausible as the acceptance of the wholeness of me. But there's just another mountain on the other side, and someone will be ready to tell you, don't be breathing hard. You need to make this look easy. Just as the cops were annoyed when Ricky said he had been repeatedly stopped because he is black, discussion of race is often dismissed or talked over unless it is in a sanctioned space. You can talk about your experience at a roundtable on race, but don't talk about yourself at a regular roundtable. It is exactly the same as when I would challenge my friends in Pleasanton near the end of high school. That again, they would say, get off your soapbox. Only now these are grown-ups who fashion themselves as allies. But these are my stories. This is what I have lived. I know what the boys I raise go through, what my husband goes through, and beyond my family, I can watch a video of it happening to Ricky. Each of us experiences these same things, but each experience has value and deserves telling. I need to write them and read them aloud to constantly remind myself of my reality. I need to hear these stories. If I think mittens, or the way I talk, or the fame I have, will make my breathing and living on this planet permissible, I am told no one wants to hear about it. I even hear it from other people of color in Hollywood. Some have climbed the mountain and have been able to assimilate so thoroughly, they think they are in a parallel universe. You're sabotaging your own success by limiting yourself to being a black woman, they say. They tell us that if we just stripped away these layers of identity, we would be perceived not for our color or gender, but for our inner core, our humanness. My humanness doesn't insulate me from racism or sexism. In fact, I think I can deal effectively with the world precisely because I am a Black woman who is so comfortable in my Black womanness. I know what I can accomplish. And anything I have accomplished, I did so not in spite of being a Black woman, but because I am a Black woman. This is not the message that assimilated people of color in Hollywood want to hear. In exchange for a temporary pass they think is permanent, these ones who've made it then turn and yell back to the others, "No, keep going. Assimilation is the key. Deny your victimhood. Let go of your identity." Better bring your mittens. That's what I know. Chapter 18. Big Bank, Take Little Bank. Dwayne and I have a ritual involving our favorite show, Nashville. I guess I should say our favorite show that I am not on. No matter what, we have to watch it together, preferably at home in Chicago. We have these twin chaise lounges in our theater room, and in winter, we each have a blanket to curl up in, fuzzy on one side, quilted on the other. We always assemble our snacks beforehand because we don't want to get up during the show. It's all about being able to barrel through the episode. Lately, we've been doing Garrett's popcorn in the tubs, half cheese, half caramel corn. Then I have my alkaline water, and he's got the bottled water he likes. And, of course, we have our phones beside us, too, so we can tweet about Nashville, which is almost as good as watching Nashville. We even have our own phone chargers ready. Go big or go home. If you don't watch the show, just understand that Deacon and Raina were everything. Through all their ups and downs, their love endured, and we adored them for it. I'm writing this in a hotel in New York City, and Dee and I have signed in under the alias Deacon Claiborne. I also check in stealth as Chacha Di Gregorio from Greece, the best dancer at St. Bernadette's, with the worst reputation. But that is another story. Without giving anything away, one of Deacon and Raina's issues as a couple in country music is that she is the huge singing star and earner in the relationship. When Deacon told Raina, "It's your world, I just live in it," that was the most honest description I have heard about the inequity of fame and finances in love. I know it rang true for me. That's how all my relationships were before Dwayne. I paid for everything. The first time my father ever met Dwayne, it was at Dad's house in Arizona. We successfully navigated the whole awkward first meeting, but at the very last second, just as we were leaving, Dad pulled Dwayne back into the house. "What do you want with my daughter?" he asked, suddenly gruff. "She's got her own shit. She's got her own house. She's got her own money. What do you want with my daughter?" He wasn't saying, "What are your intentions for my daughter's heart?" He meant, "We have been down this road before, and she's come out poorer." Dad didn't believe that a professional athlete wasn't hiding some problem that would prove a drain on my savings. "I'm doing all right by myself," Dee then awkwardly explained. "I'm not going to try to use her." He doesn't need my money, but sometimes I'm Deacon, and it really is Dwayne's world. I often work around his life because I have more flexibility. Because the basketball schedule is the basketball schedule, amen. And at the end of September, that schedule is our schedule. On top of that, he has many brand and partnership obligations. Then there are the team obligations, the NBA obligations, and in between that, there's our family. And then there's us as a couple. A lot of times I'm like, "Whatever, just tell me when I can see you." We are lucky in that we have homes in many cities now, because we're all over the place for work, and that's where I can plainly see the lines of division. I make it clear to people that there is a house I am financially responsible for in L.A., and there is the Miami home Dwayne built when he played for the Heat. "Don't judge the Black actress home that I pay for in Los Angeles," I say when folks visit. "I know you've seen the Black athlete home in Miami, but this is what I can afford." Dee thinks the disparity is funny, probably because he's loaded. There are times when we go to restaurants and Dee will purposely forget his wallet so I have to pay. Once, at the end of a large, boozy gathering, I texted him under the guise of answering a question from my publicist. I wouldn't have said, let's invite your whole team out, if I knew this was going on the Black actress Amex that you don't chip in for. He loved that one. When we were designing the Miami home, my husband kept saying things like, well, I didn't want to sign off on that until you saw it. At the end of the day, it's your money, I would answer, so do whatever you want to do. But you're the woman of the house, he'd say. You're my partner. You're here with me. That was lovely. But in all negotiations, whether it was about wallpaper or if we really needed to get an 8-foot-tall Buddha statue in the Miami house, I have learned this lesson. Big bank, take little bank. It's a simple rule dictating that whoever has more money wins. Whatever your income bracket, whoever has the power of the bigger purse in the relationship usually has the final decision. In my first marriage, I made more than my husband, so I was big bank. Now, I was decidedly little bank. The sanctity of this rule was never more apparent than when we worked out the prenup. On paper, it's an adult thing to do. Grown-ups with a certain amount of money who care for each other say, you know what? Just in case we gotta jump ship, let's make clear while we really like each other exactly what we're going in with and what we leave with. The negotiations went on for months before our August 2014 wedding. We started with the right intentions, mind you. My team and I were adamant that we have a prenup to protect myself because I got taken to the cleaners in my first marriage. Dwayne's team was all in because he had been to the cleaners with his first wife. We both basically bought our respective cleaners, plus the deli next door, and built a new wing on the library across the street. That's how bad those divorces had been. It wasn't that either of us planned on getting divorced, but we also didn't plan on getting cleaned out again, either. Better safe than losing all your money, you know? My first thought was that I wanted to leave the marriage, should things go that way, with whatever I came in with. I wanted Dwayne to know I didn't need his anything if I didn't want to be with him. I will give blowjobs in a leper colony before I take a dime from a man I am no longer in love with. That's who I am. I will cut off my nose, or my lips, I guess, to spite my face. But Dwayne felt differently. His team kept pushing. No, no, we want to give you something. Throw out some numbers. So, finally, I gave in. It was like they said, you can have whatever salad you want, and I asked for a kale salad. Actually, they replied with a note of apology, it's just iceberg lettuce for you. But you said I could have whatever I wanted, I answered. I want kale. Why would you offer me anything if you only wanted to give me iceberg? Don't you care about my health and wellness? This was all coming from Dwayne's team, yes, but the person who had proposed to me was now, in theory, lowballing me. It wasn't even about the money, really. The question for me was, what does this man think I'm worth? There were literally pages going back and forth detailing my potential worth as a wife. The money went up if I had a child, and then there were even weirder conversations about my own earning potential. When my attorney eventually had to say, fuck you, these are her quotes, meaning what I am paid to do a job, I realized we were negotiating my marriage the same way we would a sitcom deal at NBC. My team had to provide examples of my past worth, then factor in my social media power to come up with a number that I needed to protect as my future earnings. And then Dwayne's team came back with, no, actually, that's not her value. She is worth less than that. Worth less. I tried that on in my actress voices. I am worth less. Worth less? Worthless. Ah, yes. I am worthless. My number was based off my own work, whereas his angle was just, this is what I want to pay. Big bank, take little bank. It was hell, especially when you're supposed to be marrying your best friend. Finally, 3 days before the wedding, he became Dwayne again. You know why? Because I signed. He was like Jon Snow morphing from "Winter is coming" to "I'm in Miami, bitch." He became ecstatic, throwing off all the layers of anxiety. And there I was underneath them, the woman he loved. He was freed, but I was resentful. Hell, I'm still resentful. Which is why when I make him my hashtag Man Crush Monday on Instagram, I say, as per the prenup, my forever Man Crush Monday, does he regret playing hardball? Not in the least. He played to win. Thank God our wedding was fun. Honestly, our wedding saved our marriage. I fell in love with him 5 different times that night. When I say I had the time of my life, I really mean every word. After our reception, all the guests were given candles, and then a gospel choir led us in a march singing "God is trying to tell you something" from The Color Purple. So we marched with our candles, and people shared wishes for us and wishes for themselves. The choir led us into a supersized 1930s juke joint we created just for the night. Questlove was DJing, and one of my favorite bands, Guy, was on the stage. We had a rocking chair rest area for the older folks, and we were surrounded by all of our favorite people, the people who valued us for our real worth. The best thing was that people danced all night. If you left the dance floor, it was just to get more booze, and then you went right back. It went on for hours, and Dwayne and I were the very last to leave. I think about our vows sometimes. If you've ever wondered if I'll leave you, the answer is never, Dwayne said to me in front of all those people. And if you've ever wondered what I value, the answer is you. I needed to hear that, and I needed to tell him what I said in return. This day is about the two of us coming together and being the best team possible, I said. So today, I vow to love you without conditions. And I had to add one very important promise. I vow to not watch Scandal or Nashville without you. Even under the rules of Big Bank Take Little Bank, so far so good. Chapter 19, The Room Where It Happens. The text came from a number I didn't know. Prince's invites would always be this way. Last minute and straightforward, with the address of a house he was renting in Los Angeles for award seasons, or later, a hotel he was taking over for the night. My first came in 2005. I grabbed my friend's hand and showed her the text. We were at a Grammy weekend party in L.A., and we were having a great time, but this was a much better offer. "We're going," I said, "now." The whole way to the mysterious address, I was sure the invitation was a prank. Maybe, I thought, it would be better that way. I was terrified of showing up at Prince's house and being lame. I was sure there were going to be way cooler people than me there, and I was going to be the idiot who said the wrong thing. The house was at the end of a steep driveway up Mulholland, and my friend and I made our way to the door. I was still waiting for the, "Oh, there must be a mistake," but the security guy gave me a nod. Then he looked at my friend. "Did you get a text?" the large man asked as politely as possible. "No," she said. "I'm sorry," was all he said. Now, my friend is dope as hell and also happens to be someone famous. You know her, and if I told you her name, you would immediately know that, of course, she could hang. But Prince planned his invite list like a precision instrument, and I had the golden ticket that night. "You have to go in," she said. "Okay, the car will take you home. Love you," I said, because there was no way I was not going in. And I felt lucky to have a friend who understood what this invitation meant. The first thing I noticed as I walked through the door was that this was definitely Prince's house. Purple tapestries, music blasting, candles everywhere. "Dearly beloved," I said to myself. To my right was a huge staircase, and to my left, just beyond the crowd, stood Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey, and Mary J. Blige in a small circle. They were still in their Grammy party gowns, looking like my 90s soulful pop fantasies come to life. "Oh my God, Gabrielle," Mary said, waving me over. That picture we took at Quincy's party? I have it on my mantle. I see you every day.
Really?
I asked, meaning it. Mary J. Blige had a picture of me?